So I thought, as I've got a little bit of time to fill, what I would aim to do is introduce idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis as a diagnostic problem, discuss how we make the diagnosis, and the next two talks will cover more on the radiology and pathology, and then, of course, outline why the diagnosis is important, so the treatment challenges that we face in clinical practice, followed by how we might consider to treat our patients, and also what the future looks like now that we're in a position to actually treat idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So IPF, as I'm sure you know, is a progressive fibrosing lung disease of unknown etiology. It causes breathlessness for our patients, and as you'll know from your own clinical practice, it causes inevitably progressive scarring of the lungs that results in patients developing respiratory failure from which they ultimately die. And until recently, there was nothing that we could do to prevent this pattern of disease progression. Our patients inevitably got worse. Now, in the UK, we know that IPF is becoming more common. So in the UK as a whole, back in 1990, there were about 3,000 new cases of IPF per year. By the year 2000, there were about 4,000 new cases of IPF per year. And by the year 2010, there were about 5,000 new cases of IPF per year. And it seems to be that this is being replicated in other countries. In the United States, they're seeing a similar increase in the incidence of IPF. And it's not just that we're doing more CT scans and getting better at diagnosing it. It seems that the condition is genuinely becoming more common, possibly because these patients are the same patients who 20 years ago were dying of their ischemic heart disease. Now that we've seen improvements in cardiovascular care, we're instead seeing them live long enough to develop their pulmonary fibrosis. Now, importantly, we probably underestimate the importance of IPF as a disease. So in the UK, virtually every patient with IPF dies from their IPF. So there are just under 5,000 deaths a year. If you put that in the context of cancer, IPF would be about number 10 or number 11 in the cause of deaths, which actually would make it, or does make it, a very important problem. And again, to contextualize it, in the UK each year there are 500,000 deaths. So that 5,000 IPF deaths means that one in every 100 deaths in the UK is due to idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So it is, again, an important problem that we underestimate, I think. To make matters worse, we've got no better at treating it over the last 15 to 20 years. So what this graph shows is that survival outcomes for patients, whether they were diagnosed in the year 2000 or whether they were diagnosed in the year 2012, have remained the same. Median survival from diagnosis is about 3 years. Now, hopefully, as I'll show you with new treatments, that may be changing. And again, to keep hammering home this message about the importance of the disease, 5-year survival with IPF is about 20%. So 4 out of 5 of every patient we see in clinic will be dead within 5 years. And that puts it down there with some of the very nasty cancers in terms of expected outcomes. And I think what gives me hope is that when I was at medical school 20 years ago, both melanoma and breast cancer had 5-year survivals that are worse than IPF now. And over 20 years, we've seen dramatic improvements in survival for what were once considered almost untreatable diseases. So I think it is possible to change outcomes. So how do we go about diagnosing IPF? Well, in the year 2001, we saw the first publication of international multidisciplinary guidelines. And the important thing that these guidelines did was that they separated out the different fibrosing lung disorders into very clear and distinct groups. So before 2001, we tended to lump everything together. If there was fibrosis on a chest X-ray, we called it idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis or cryptogenic fibrosing alveolitis or fibrosing idiopathic interstitial pneumonia. But in the year 2001, it was agreed that we would use the term idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis to describe patients who have the histological lesion of usual interstitial pneumonia without apparent cause. And the guidelines were very important because they've helped us understand exactly how the disease behaves, but they were also critical to the development of clinical trials in this disease area. The other thing that the guidelines did was enshrine this idea of the multidisciplinary meeting as a way of diagnosing IPF, the idea that you get a more accurate diagnosis if you involve the clinician, the radiologist, and the pathologist together. And my picture of an elephant illustrates an Indian parable of the blind man and the elephant. So the parable goes that three blind men go out for a walk and they bump into an elephant. One grabs hold of the trunk and thinks he's got a snake. The other one grabs hold of the tail and thinks he's got a rope. And the other one walks into the body of the elephant and thinks he's hit a brick wall. If they all talk to each other, they'll quickly work out it's an elephant, but each on their own has no idea what they're dealing with. And the same is true of fibrosing lung disease. If we talk with our radiologists and pathologists, then actually we have a much better understanding of the disease than if we try and do it on our own. And the same is true for the radiologist. The radiologist can spot UIP pattern on CT scan, but he doesn't know if the patient's perhaps got rheumatoid arthritis as the explanation for that appearance. The same for the pathologist. They can see UIP, but they can't be certain that there isn't a clinical explanation for that appearance. And so this is, generally speaking, the diagnostic algorithm that we go through in our unit. So obviously we start with history and clinical examination. Chest X-ray and spirometry really form a sort of screening tool to tell us that the patient has pathology that requires further investigation. And of course, the first thing we do, or the most important thing we do in trying to establish a diagnosis, is HRCT. At this point, we sit down with our radiologist and we have a discussion about the CT appearance. And probably in about two-thirds of cases, it's possible at this point to be fairly confident about the diagnosis, in which case we can then go down this algorithm of assessing disease severity and excluding disease-related complications. But in about a third of patients, it's not possible with CT and clinical history alone to know what the diagnosis is. And so we then go down this arm of the algorithm and consider more invasive testing. So either bronchoscopy with bronchoalveolar lavage and possibly biopsy, which could be transbronchial or cryobiopsy. And in about 10 to 15% of our patients, we go on to perform a surgical lung biopsy. Of course, following this, we then repeat the MDT assessment. And by this stage, we aim to achieve a diagnosis. The guidelines were updated again in 2013, and I won't go into that in more detail at this stage, but I thought I would illustrate things with a case. So this gentleman is pretty typical of the sort of patient we see with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. He's a man in his 60s. He's presenting with breathlessness and cough. He was a former aviation engineer but has no clear exposure history of note. He was a smoker but stopped over 10 years before presentation, and it, as is common for many of these patients, has a background history of ischemic heart disease. On examination, he was clubbed. Resting oxygen saturations are 96% on Roux-Mayer and have very typical bibasal end inspiratory crepitations. His autoimmune screen was negative and the rest of his blood count was unremarkable. So this is his CT appearance, and you can see that he has a subpleural abnormality, which here starts to become honeycomb change. He has more disease at the bases than he has at the apices, and there really isn't any ground glass change or anything else that we might be looking for to exclude the possibility that this is IPF. So this is the sort of CT appearance that we see in early UIP-IPF. And the guidelines, of course, have got criteria on which to base our interpretation of the CT findings. And again, I think the next talk will go into more detail. Similarly, the next talk will deal with all of this in more detail as well. But I think the characteristic things we're looking for on the CT in an IPF patient is a subpleural distribution that's predominantly basal. Ideally, there's honeycombing. Our radiologist looks for what he describes as this propeller blade distribution, which I'll illustrate, and then we're looking for the absence of anything that goes against the diagnosis. And when we talk about this propeller blade, what we tend to see at the lung apex is that the abnormality tends to be anterior, and as you get down to the bases, it tends to be posterior. So it goes from anterior to posterior as it goes down to the bases. And again, that's very characteristic of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So this patient, we diagnosed him at MDT with IPF. He was initially started on N-acetylcysteine because we had no other treatments available, but when pirfenidone became available, he was started on that, and he's remained actually fairly stable over the last 2 to 3 years. So a second case just to think about. This one is a 64-year-old female. You can see there's a theme when it comes to IPF cases that The history is one usually of breathlessness and occasionally cough. She too was an ex-smoker. She had no other symptoms of note and no other past medical history of note. Again, on examination, she had the typical thymine bibasal end inspiratory crepitations and normal blood tests with negative autoimmune profile. This lady actually had very limited disease at presentation. You can see that there is subpleural abnormality with some reticulation, but there is an absence of honeycombing. And so actually in this case, we went on to do a surgical lung biopsy because we didn't feel it was possible to make a definite diagnosis based on this CT alone. So there we go. We confirmed UIP on a VATS biopsy. We made an MDT diagnosis of IPF. Again, this was about 4 years ago, so we didn't have access to antifibrotic therapy at the time, and she was started on treatment with N-acetylcysteine. 6 months after we made the diagnosis, she returned to our clinic urgently, having developed rapid worsening of her breathlessness over the preceding 2 weeks. She'd gone from essentially an almost unlimited exercise tolerance to now struggling to walk even 10 to 15 meters, and really struggling to climb up the stairs at home. Apart from this change in her breathlessness, she was otherwise actually well in herself with no fever, no constitutional symptoms, no sputum. When she came to see us, she was afebrile, but she did have scattered coarse crepitations. She wasn't fluid overloaded, nor did she have any clinical signs of thromboembolic disease. So this is her baseline CT, which I've shown you already, with the subtle subpleural interstitial change. This is the CT when she returned to us reporting the increased breathlessness. And you can see that the previously very subtle change has become much coarser, and there's now this diffuse ground glass attenuation throughout both lung fields. So our concern was that she'd had an acute exacerbation of her IPF. We admitted her to hospital. We did exclude thromboembolic disease. We did an echocardiogram, which was normal. And we treated her with corticosteroids and antibiotics. Despite that, this is her CT 1 week later. And it perhaps won't surprise you to know that we confirmed the diagnosis on autopsy. And so this unfortunate lady had an acute exacerbation. Now, the thing to know about acute exacerbations of IPF is they're not like acute exacerbations of asthma or COPD. In an acute exacerbation of IPF, what we see is the development of diffuse alveolar damage throughout the lungs of these patients, which is what this illustrates. You sort of see the sloughing off of the alveolar epithelium. You see fluid and blood within the alveolar spaces. You see gross architectural distortion. This is exactly the same thing that happens in ARDS on the intensive care unit. So when these patients are having acute exacerbations of their IPF, they're essentially developing ARDS on top of their pre-existing fibrosing lung disease. And for reasons we don't fully understand, IPF patients seem to be uniquely susceptible to this form of lung injury occurring out of the blue. And although we consider it to occur in the absence of infection, it seems likely that infection is one of the upstream triggers, that maybe it starts as a viral pneumonia that rapidly progresses to acute lung injury and ARDS. In the same way, patients are susceptible to this sort of exacerbation following surgery or following treatment with chemotherapy drugs. And so it's something always to bear in mind with the IPF patient who is presenting with worsening breathlessness. And so just to make the point again, we define an acute exacerbation as a clinically significant deterioration in lung function of unidentifiable cause in patients with underlying IPF. The diagnostic criteria were published in 2007 and explicitly excluded infection. We've just updated the guidelines now, and hopefully they'll be published in the next 6 months, and we've been less dogmatic about infection on this occasion. In essence, what we're looking for is the development of diffuse alveolar damage on a background of pre-existing IPF. And part of the reason for removing infection from it is that actually, whether you're hospitalized with an acute exacerbation or whether you're hospitalized with an infection, if you've got underlying IPF, the outcomes are very, very similar. And that's to say, in both circumstances, if you're admitted to hospital with respiratory failure and background IPF, the 30-day mortality is in excess of 50%. So these patients really are very susceptible to anything that upsets the normal balance of things. So just quickly, and again, I don't want to touch too much on the radiology, but there are a few things to think about when you see a patient with a rapid worsening of IPF. And of course, there is an acute exacerbation to think about, but they can develop heart failure. They can develop opportunistic infection. It can be a drug reaction, potentially. And sometimes you might overestimate the importance of the symptoms and the CT signs. So the expiratory CT can give the false impression of an acute exacerbation, as can the use of contrast with a CTPA scan. So just to illustrate it, this is an acute exacerbation with the before CT scan and the scan during an acute exacerbation. But it's quite hard to differentiate from some of the other causes. So this is a patient with pulmonary edema, with the before and after scan, and the ground glass actually got better with diuretics. This is a patient who actually turned out to have pneumocystis carinii. Now, this is actually quite an unusual problem in this patient group, but nonetheless, we should never forget about the role of atypical infections in causing acute deterioration. This example is actually just an expiratory CT. So you can see the effect of failing to take a deep breath in gives you this spurious impression of ground glass change. And then this example is a patient who's had a CTPA. It perhaps doesn't project so wonderfully well, but there is contrast here within the vessels, and you can see that contrast gives an impression of diffuse ground glass change. So again, the technique for the CT scan is important. So having touched on the challenges of diagnosis and diagnosis of disease complications, I thought I would touch briefly on treatment of IPF, and to do that, it's worth thinking about what we're trying to do with therapy. So IPF causes irreversible destruction of the lung. This is the typical appearance of UIP, where you've lost the normal alveolar architecture. We know that that results in different patterns of disease progression. Some patients progress rapidly, some more slowly, and of course, 1 in 20 of them have these acute exacerbations. But what we do see in our patients is inexorable progression of disease. So this study was one that we did at the Brompton, where we gave our patients spirometers and asked them to measure their forced vital capacity at home every day. So every dot on this graph is a forced vital capacity measurement done on a different day. And you can see that over a course of a year and a half, our patient has inexorably lost lung function. You can also see one of the challenges with FVC is that it's a fairly variable measurement. So if you'd seen him in clinic on this day, and then 12 months later on this day, you might actually get the false impression the disease was stable. But actually, by doing it so much, we can see the true trajectory of his disease decline. One of the challenges we have when seeing a new patient with IPF is that we don't know how the disease will behave. So that patient's had relatively slow progression over a year and a half. This patient, by contrast, who started off with a lot better lung function, you can see how quickly his FVC is disappearing. Crosses zero before 300 days. He died 210 days after entering into this study. So some patients have incredibly rapid disease. And then, of course, there are the patients with acute exacerbation. So this patient lost 25% of his lung function in a three-week period of time. So we have these different patterns of disease behavior that we're not very good at identifying when we first see the patient in clinic. Furthermore, we've got the challenge of what we're trying to do with our treatment. So the patient's getting inexorably worse. What we would ideally like to do is make the diagnosis, give a drug, and cure them. I don't think we're ever going to do that. So the next best thing we can hope for is to make the diagnosis and give a drug which prevents the development of any more fibrosis, so keeps the disease absolutely stable. Again, this is a tough disease to treat. It's taken us many years to develop therapies, and so I think it's unrealistic that we're going to achieve that straight away. And so actually what we're hoping to do is to slow down the rate of disease progression, to prevent the disease getting worse as quickly as it otherwise would. And of course, the conceptual challenge with that is that even though we give a drug to our patients, we still expect that in 12 months' time they're going to feel worse than they did when we started them on treatment. It's just they won't be quite as bad as they would have been without therapy. And I think it's important for us to get that message across when we start treatment, because otherwise our patients come back disappointed that you've given them a drug and they don't feel better. So just to very quickly whip through the clinical trial data, the first drug we have available is pirfenidone. There were, first of all, the capacity studies, one of which was positive, one of which was negative. At the time, it was possible through meta-analysis to show that pirfenidone almost certainly did work in slowing down the rate of disease progression in IPF, and that was enough for us to get the drug approved in Europe, but it wasn't good enough for the Americans, who didn't want to include some of the Japanese data. And so for the Americans, the ASCEND study was conducted, and this was a 52-week clinical trial of patients with IPF treated with pirfenidone or placebo. And as you'll all know by now, pirfenidone effectively slowed the rate of disease decline. It halved the rate at which patients got worse. And if you look at all of the data now available from the clinical trials, that ultimately leads to improvements in survival in patients treated with antifibrotic therapy. Of course, pirfenidone causes side effects, predominantly nausea, gastrointestinal upset, and photosensitive rash. Our other drug choice is nintedanib, so a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. The first study of this was published in 2001 as a dose-ranging study, which showed that compared to placebo, the highest dose of nintedanib was effective in slowing disease progression. That led on to two phase three clinical trials run in parallel. And both of those studies, again, demonstrated that treatment with nintedanib halved the rate of disease decline over 12 months. And if you model this out, what that should mean is that for the average patient treated with drug, one would hope that it will improve their life expectancy somewhere between 12 to 24 months if you can slow the rate of decline by 50%. Now, clearly, we're waiting for real-life data to prove that, but I think that's one of the important things to keep in mind when treating patients. Nintedanib was also shown to reduce the rate of acute exacerbations in the treated group, and there was a trend towards improved survival, although the study wasn't powered to look for a mortality benefit. Nintedanib also causes side effects. It doesn't cause a photosensitive rash, but it does cause diarrhea and, to a lesser extent, nausea. One might ask how we make the decision for individual patients about choosing an antifibrotic drug. And I think that remains challenging. So with all the clinical trial data available, I don't think we can truly separate the efficacy of these two drugs. Both pirfenidone and nintedanib appear to slow the rate of disease decline by about 50%. There are, however, some differences between them. So there are differences in the dosing regimen. One is three times a day, the other is twice a day. There are differences in side effect profile. And believe it or not, patients in London do worry about photosensitive rashes, perhaps more of a problem here. There are contraindications, so nintedanib is relatively contraindicated in patients on warfarin or high-dose anticoagulation. There are issues of cost-effectiveness. Now, this is going to vary from country to country. In the UK, the drug prices are equivalent, and so cost-effectiveness isn't an issue, but it will vary from territory to territory depending on pricing. And then, of course, I think probably the most important, certainly for us, is patient choice. So we explain to patients the available evidence, explain side effects and pros and cons of both drugs, and essentially guide them to make a decision about which one they prefer. And then, of course, there's physician experience, and I think one can't underestimate the importance of physicians' knowledge of how a drug works and behaves and the side effects that it causes. And that all, of course, plays into the physician decision about which drug to use. And then the last couple of minutes, I'll just touch on some of the challenges all of this creates in having treatments available. The first one is knowing if the drug works or not. So I've already told you what we're trying to do is slow down disease progression. I've already told you that forced vital capacity is quite a variable measurement. And so the problem we have is knowing whether what we're seeing represents treatment success or failure. So maybe in this first patient, you could say that my treatment has been successful. The FVC got better. Probably it's measurement variation, but at the very least, things have been stable. On the other hand, this patient has got worse following treatment, and what I can't know is how much worse he would have got without pirfenidone. Maybe the pirfenidone has done nothing. Maybe it has halved the rate at which his FVC has got worse. But I have a real challenge in clinical practice knowing which of those things is true. And at the moment, I have no good way to decide for that patient whether treatment is working. And just to remind you, what we're trying to do is change the trajectory from this to this. So I expect him to get worse on pirfenidone. I just don't know how fast. So I think in the future we will start to use biomarkers. So this is a study that we've published from our unit at the Brompton, looking at biomarkers of collagen turnover. And we're in the process of doing a clinical trial with nintedanib to see whether these biomarkers tell us about response to treatment. Because if they do, we might then have a simple blood measure we can start to use to make decisions about whether we continue therapy. There are also challenges around personalized medicine. Are there patients who might do better with pirfenidone or who might do better with nintedanib? At the moment, we don't know, but again, work is ongoing to see if we can make decisions up front about who might respond better to which drug. And that becomes increasingly important when you know that there are more than 25 trials of different compounds targeting different aspects of IPF pathogenesis going on around the world at the moment. So all of these drugs around the side are being used in various stages of clinical trials to target different aspects of disease pathogenesis. So we know that alveolar epithelial injury is important. We can target that. We know that activation of wound healing cascades is important. We can target that. We know that damage to the epithelium is important, so we can try and restore epithelial integrity. We know that fibroblasts produce collagen and drive the production of scar tissue, so we can try and target that and damp down the rate at which scar tissue is produced. And we also know these patients develop premature pulmonary hypertension, so we can target that. Now, not all of these drugs is going to work, but hopefully one, two, three or more might make it through to the clinic, and then we're going to have to make decisions about how to use those alongside the current treatments. And then finally, I think it's important to bring this back to the patients and to remember how the patients feel. So IPF is a disease that kills people on average 3 years after diagnosis. And this is a quote from one of my patients in one of our bits of research. I'm only 65. I've just retired. I was looking forward to traveling and seeing my grandchildren grow up. The thought of having 3 years or left to live is terrifying and depressing. Of course, I want to have treatment for my IPF. Having a medication available gives me hope that things can be controlled and that I may have time to do some of the things I plan for in my retirement. And so I don't think we should underestimate how important it is that we now have drugs available. They're not perfect drugs. They come with challenges. As I've discussed, making the diagnosis comes with challenges. But actually, we are in a position to start to do things, and hopefully that will continue to improve in the future. So just to summarize, IPF is a terrible disease that hopefully none of us will ever get. It does inevitably get worse. We do thankfully have treatments, and those treatments do slow disease progression, which should ultimately mean our patients can live longer, and in living longer, the period of their good quality life should be extended. However, to manage this, we need to make the diagnosis correctly. We need to establish it early. And once patients are on drug, we need to help them manage the side effects. So thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you, Professor Maher, for this very elegant presentation. Is there any questions?
You look like a big advocate for treatment. A couple of questions. When you get your 80-year-old with an IPF, you know, some of the changes on CT scan are usually related to old age. And it's difficult sometimes to put things together to decide to treat or not to treat when you're diagnosed at the age of 80, knowing that disease is around 6 years. So would you treat at any age? That's my first question. And the second question I do have, any data on combining treatment between the two molecules?
So your first question is an interesting challenge that I ignored in my talk. So I think we do know that as people get older, they accumulate changes in their lungs that on CT scan give the appearance of fibrosis. And you will see things in 80-year-old lungs that you wouldn't expect to see in 40-year-old lungs. I think one of the sort of things we don't want to do is to sort of pick things up in asymptomatic patients and treat those. So I think in the sort of patient where you're referred from a gastroenterologist, somebody who's had an abdominal CT scan that shows some basal change that might or might not be fibrosis, in that patient I would simply observe what's going to happen. However, if the patient has come to you as a doctor saying, I feel increasingly breathless, to me that's a sign they've got significant disease, and that patient I would treat irrespective of age. So I think the clinical context and evidence of progression, even if that evidence is just change in symptoms, is important. And I think we need to do more to understand that sort of early disease and understand whether in all patients it leads on to significant fibrosis or whether only in a proportion. Your second question was, combination. So at the moment, I would hesitate to combine the two drugs. I think the reasons for doing that are partly because of the overlapping side effect profile and the tolerability profile, partly simply due to the cost. So I think in most territories, it's not feasible to combine the two drugs. And I think the third reason is it's going to be important to prove that the two drugs together work. And as a sort of important caution, there's been a recent study of pirfenidone and N-acetylcysteine together. And it seems that N-acetylcysteine actually blocks the positive benefit of pirfenidone. So I don't think we can always assume that adding two drugs together is going to give you the benefits that you anticipate. So I think we really do need clinical trial evidence before we routinely add the two together. I think a patient on a transplant list where you're trying to keep them alive for a few extra months, maybe I would. But in general, I think we need evidence before we do it.
Thank you, Professor. Excellent talk. Here.
Where are you? There you are.
Okay. So in real life, sometimes things are different, you know. Is there any time when it is too late to start antifibrotic drug, regardless of what molecule we're going to choose? I mean, sometimes you get a patient from another clinician, they might have, there's some who are still using steroids, and you feel that the disease is already progressed. So is it too late at any stage?
So I think in terms of effect on change in lung function over time, both the drugs would seem to be effective in patients with an FVC of 90% or an FVC of 50%. But I think in terms of what you can hope to gain, it changes as the disease gets worse. So a patient with an FVC of 50% perhaps has a life expectancy of 6 months, and so the gain of slowing further deterioration is much, much smaller. I think the other thing that's coming through from clinical practice is that those patients with advanced disease are much more susceptible to the side effects of the drug, and you can imagine sort of diarrhea that causes you to go to the toilet twice a day is not a problem if you've got an excellent exercise tolerance, but if you're on oxygen at home and getting to the bathroom is a massive problem, then the impact of that side effect is going to be much greater. So I think the risk-benefit analysis does change as the disease becomes more severe. I wouldn't say no to treating those patients, but I would reflect on the balance between the side effects and the potential benefits.
When we use this new medication,
sorry, deep pulmonary function test.
Did pulmonary function test ameliorate under this treatment, the new treatment?
So, again, in clinical practice, what we are seeing is that the rate of decline in patients on treatment is less than we historically saw before therapy. So, it does seem to slow the rate of disease decline. I think what we're waiting to conclusively see is whether slowing that decline in lung function has longer-term impacts on both survival and quality of life. Now, my anticipation is that it will, but clearly we're going to need to collect real-world and registry data going forward to demonstrate those sort of changes. And I think that's what happened in pulmonary hypertension. It's what's happened in rheumatology with rheumatoid arthritis. But I think we are going to have to wait a few more years before we have the definitive evidence.
Thank you. I would like to ask you. Sorry, please.
Oh, competing questions. Okay. We good? Ladies.
Marie-Louise.
What are the reasons that would push you to stop treatment?
So, in terms of stopping treatment, I think I would stop treatment if patients really are struggling with side effects. And clearly there is a balance to be struck between improving life expectancy and quality of life versus tolerability. And about a quarter to a third of patients with pirfenidone, where we've had longer-term experience, really do struggle to tolerate treatment. And I think in that circumstance, you have to make a decision about the balance between side effects and quality of life. I think the other scenario where I perhaps wouldn't stop but would think about changing treatment is patients who've got rapidly progressive disease on therapy. So if they lose more than 10% of their forced vital capacity in 6 months on treatment, I would use that as a trigger to change them to the alternative drug now that we have two available.
Sorry, I have two questions. One question is, if you have a patient who has mild disease and it's stable, would you treat? And the second question is, which one of these two drugs would you choose and how do you compare it with steroids?
So the first question is, I don't really believe there's anything, I don't think truly stable disease exists. I think there are slowly progressive cases and more rapidly progressive cases. But I think if the patient has come to you with a history of progressive breathlessness, that disease will inevitably get worse in the future. So that patient I would treat. The ones with more slowly progressive disease arguably have more to benefit from over the longer term. How do I think the drugs stack up against each other? Well, I think corticosteroids, particularly in high dose, are bad things for patients with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. There is probably still a role for low-dose corticosteroids as a management for cough in some patients. And in patients with end-stage disease, I will still use corticosteroids for their sort of weight gain effects. But I think as first-line treatment, I would avoid them, and I would avoid them in doses of more than 10 milligrams of prednisolone or equivalent. Between the pirfenidone and nintedanib, I think at the moment they're pretty much equal in terms of efficacy. The clinical trial data suggests that both of them halve the rate of disease decline. So I don't think we can say that one is better than the other from an efficacy perspective.
Okay, thank you. Last question. Dr. Khoury.
Do you use morphometric measurements to evaluate deterioration, which is numerical, to evaluate deterioration of the HRCT, for instance?
So historically, we've struggled to use the CT to show change, and I think that's because the human eye needs to see quite a lot of change before we know that it's happened, and so forced vital capacity has always been a better way to determine change than CT. That may now be changing with sort of computerized techniques where the CT, where the computer can break the CT down into tiny little fragments and can give a much better quantification of how fibrosis is changing. So we're working with a couple of groups to see whether sort of computerized interrogation of CT data actually gives us more information. Because on a visual level, you can, the CT I showed at the beginning, you can see the differences between early patients and late patients. And in theory, it seems like a very nice way of showing change over time, being able to spot it on the CT. But I think we need the tools to do it better. And I don't think the human eye, even when it's a really good radiologist, is sharp enough to see subtle change.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We don't have time.